This is a Crestview Bible podcast. For more information, visit crestviewhutch.org.
I think I've opened with this illustration before, but when I think of the word protection, my mind immediately runs to the town of Protection, Kansas, which somehow never manages to be protected from tornadoes or severe weather, but that's a whole other story. The backstory of how the town is named what it is this. Protection is a city in Comanche County. The community was named for a protective tariff that rewarded industrialists who wanted protection from foreign competitors. That doesn't happen in our world, by the way. But this was debated in the 1884 presidential campaign, in which Grover Cleveland became the first Democrat elected since before the Civil War, defeating James Blaine, and local Republicans were believed to have supported the tax. So rewarding industrialists, or our word today would be entrepreneurs, who want protection from foreign competition. And so they called their town Protection to help clarify who they were. Now, last time we were in 1 Samuel, we looked at 1 Samuel 18 and how David was facing increasing hostility from Saul. And there were some expectations that some things we came to expect as God is with us. Whether we're an anointed one like David, or whether we're a New Testament believer with the promise that God is with us always, even to the end of the age, living life in this world, we can have confidence that we're not alone and that God is with us. And as God's with us, we can expect people of faith around us. We can expect people who are hostile and envious. That'll happen. And we can also expect that God will protect us. That's what we saw last time, that God will protect us. So protection just seems like this amazing idea that God's protecting me and my life's just going to be rosy and it's going to be so good. But what does it really look like on the ground? Well, as we continue to see the rise of David and the decline of Saul in these chapters, we're going to get some clarity, especially in 1 Samuel 19 and 20, about how God protects his people. Now, the hard thing that we have to come to terms with in the Bible is we don't see things like what we're going to learn in these passages when life is perfect and rosy. So a lot of times our elders will come to you and say, anything we could be praying for you about? And a lot of times we get, well, no, my life's going pretty well. And that's kind of scary to hear that. Because when life's going pretty well, you don't really need God. I mean, you're not really learning much. It's easy to drift into complacency. And I'm not saying you have to make up some theatrical story, but I mean, let's be honest, that the deepest lessons that we learn when it comes to our Christian lives come in suffering and come through the difficult times. There's a reason that most of the Gospels, where's the content for most of the Gospels found? It's in the last week of Jesus' life. That's what they're written about. All that suffering and all that cross are where they landed. Now, it landed there because that's maybe the most important event in history, right? But it also landed there, I think, to subtly instruct us that it's in times of suffering that's going to be the norm, where you're going to grow the most as a Christian. And that's also the reason why I think nearly a third of 1 Samuel, so really chapters 20 through 31, are going to end up with David, the Lord's anointed, being on the run and scared for his life. And you might think, well, how can that happen? I mean, doesn't God have his back? Yeah. God wants us to see that difficulty doesn't mean that he's not with us. Difficulty may be God's way of helping us see that he's with us, and that he's protecting us, and that he's for us when others are against us. So let's not miss these lessons from our Father. I hope you can see what an amazing protector our God is today, and I hope you can see it through these difficult chapters. So if you don't have a relationship with God today, who's got your back? Who's the one stepping into the mess of your life where you sometimes find yourself? Who's the one stepping into that, giving you firm footing? Who's the one giving you perseverance? Who's the one that's renewing your heart in the midst of that difficulty? So I think this is one of the best apologetics for Christianity. We have something to offer when life just plain stinks. When you can't dig any deeper and find anything in yourself. When you can't turn over a new leaf and affect change. When you can't do something about that. That's where the good news of the Bible says, God's saying, I can. I can change that. I can change hearts like that. And so that's why Jesus invites, remember in Matthew, come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. This is what Jesus is doing. So we have something to offer you when life stinks. And our God, like the song says, is the one who walks on the waters, who speaks to the sea, who stands in the fire beside me. He roars like a lion, he bled as the lamb, and he carries my healing in his hands. And so today I want you to come to know him as we look into these chapters. And if you do know him, then do all you can to prepare yourself to be able to stand when the evil day comes. Because you're going to face opposition in this world. There's going to be weeks in your life where things don't go right. There's going to be circumstances that aren't what you anticipated. And so if your life's going like fairly rosy right now, prepare yourself to stand in that evil day when it comes. Equip your heart with truth. And today, some of us in this room are going through those evil days. We're going through difficult seasons. We're in a head-scratching time going, "What God, what in the world are you up to?" And so I want you to look to God for your protection. So if your life is relative ease and comfort, prepare your heart for suffering. Strengthen your faith in God, your fortress today. So, I invite you to join me as we see four ways that God, our fortress, works for our protection. Four ways that God, our fortress, works for our protection. Let's begin reading in 1 Samuel 19, verse 1. Here's what we read there. And Saul spoke to Jonathan, his son, and to all his servants, that they should kill David. But Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted much in David. And Jonathan told David, "Saul, my father, seeks to kill you. Therefore be on your guard in the morning. Stay in a secret place and hide yourself, and I'll go out and stand beside my father in the field where you are, and I'll speak to my father about you, and if I learn anything, I will tell you." And Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul, his father, and said to him, "Let not the king sin against his servant David, because he's not sinned against you, because his deeds have brought good to you. For he took his life in his hand, and he struck down the Philistine, and the Lord worked a great salvation for all Israel. You saw it and rejoiced. Why then will you sin against innocent blood by killing David without cause?" And Saul listened to the voice of Jonathan, and Saul swore, "As the Lord lives, he shall not be put to death." And Jonathan called David, and Jonathan reported to him all these things. And Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he was in his presence as before. This is God's word. Thanks be to God. So we're going to work through these next two chapters to see four ways that God, our fortress, works for our protection. And first of all, God may work for our protection through simple appeals. Through simple appeals. That's what's happening in this chapter, right? Chapter 19 begins with a staff meeting where Saul says, "Okay, you got the cabinet together. Here's the one agenda item I have. Kill David." And we get the rub. It has to do with Jonathan and David. That Jonathan delighted in David. So he went and told him of the plan and gave him instructions to be on guard, to stay in a secret place, to hide. Jonathan had a plan to discuss David with his father, to reason with him. And then Jonathan would let David know what's up. And so we move to see Jonathan and Saul. And Jonathan's reasoning was airtight. "David's not your enemy. Don't sin against him. David's done all kinds of good for you. Remember Goliath? Do you remember him? Have you ever heard of the story, David and Goliath?" That's kind of what Jonathan's saying to Saul. Remember that? "David risked his life to fight and defeat him, and you rejoiced. So why try to kill him then without cause?" And Saul listened to Jonathan's voice and swore that as the Lord lives, David wouldn't be put to death. So Jonathan called David, reported this, and David was restored to Saul's presence as before. Sometimes God works for our protection in simple ways like this, right? Just simple appeals. It takes someone reasoning with someone who's not thinking straight. In that simple conversation, the appeals are made, life is better. God was working in this. And we know, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. So sometimes God works through simple appeals. Secondly, this morning we see a progression in the madness, which leads us to see that God may work our protection through planned escapes. Through planned escapes. Let's pick up reading in verse 8 and read down through verse 17. And there was war again. And David went out and fought with the Philistines and struck them with a great blow so that they fled before him. Then a harmful spirit from the Lord came upon Saul as he sat in his house with his spear in his hand. And David was playing the lyre. And Saul sought to pin David to the wall with the spear, but he eluded Saul so that he struck the spear into the wall. And David fled and escaped that night. Saul sent messengers to David's house to watch him that he might kill him in the morning. But Michal, David's wife, told him, "If you don't escape with your life tonight, tomorrow you'll be killed." So Michal let David down through the window, and he fled away and escaped. And Michal took an image and laid it on the bed and put a pillow of goat's hair at its head and covered it with clothes. And when Saul sent messengers to take David, she said, "He's sick." Then Saul sent the messengers to see David, saying, "Bring him up to me in the bed that I may kill him." And when the messengers came in, behold, the image was in the bed and the pillow of goat's hair at his head. And Saul said to Michal, "Why have you deceived me thus and let my enemy go so that he has escaped?" And Michal answered Saul, "He said to me, 'Let me go. Why should I kill you?'" So sometimes God protects through planned escapes. It's a good thing Saul didn't kill his prized fighter earlier in the chapter, because in verse 8, there was war again. And David went out and fought and struck the Philistines with a great blow so that they fled before him. Why is that significant? Well, just listen. He struck them with a great blow so that they fled before him. But a harmful spirit comes upon Saul. He's chilling in the palace again with his spear in his hand like he always does. It's crazy. I mean, this is going to be the third time now that David was almost pinned to the wall with a spear. Happened twice in chapter 18, and like I said last week, one time would have been enough for me. I just would have never gone back to the palace. Yeah. Love the opportunity. Going to have to pass on this one. So the spear. David was playing the lyre again. Saul sought to strike David to the wall with a great blow. So there it is again, the great blow. So that the spear went into the wall. And David was now escaping and being watched. So David struck the Philistines with a great blow, and they fled before him. Now Saul tries to strike David with a great blow, and he flees before him. So verse 11 shows that Saul sent messengers to watch him, that he might kill him. I mean, just imagine that, hanging out at your house, knowing that there's snipers outside ready to kill you. And that's what's going on for David here. This wasn't looking good. Simple appeals for protection may have worked to get him some time back in the palace, but things quickly turned on a dime. And some of us face emotional people like this around us. Things are going fine, and then just they snap. They turn on a dime. We've reasoned with them, but now it's just spiraled out of control. And in this case, it's another child of Saul who comes to David's aid. So earlier in the chapter, it was Saul's son Jonathan who came to David's aid. Now it's Saul's daughter Michal, who happens to be David's wife, comes to David's aid. And she warns him, "If you don't escape tonight, you're going to die tomorrow." And so we get this story of windows and switcheroos, right? She let David down through a window and he escaped. And then she took an image. Now we don't know what's going on with her being an image there. This is a household god that was known as a teraphim. We don't know what it was doing there. It kind of reminds you like Jacob and Rachel when they were escaping from Laban. Remember, she was sitting on her household gods and using that as an excuse. There was household gods there. But Michal took this image, covered it with hair and clothes to make it look like someone lying in bed. And when Saul's messengers came to get him, she said, "He's not feeling well." She could have almost said, like, feel him, he's stone cold. You know, like, there's no life here. He's just not feeling well. And so the messengers are sent back, and Saul says, I don't care if he's in bed, bring him to me, I'll kill him there. So the messengers came in, and they found that the switcheroo had happened, and they reported to Saul, and he had some questions for his daughter. Why'd you deceive me? Why'd you let my enemy escape? And shrewd Michal replied, well, he said, let me go. Why should I kill you? So this is quite an elaborate scheme, but God used it to protect his anointed. So God may use things like that to protect his people, things like planned escapes. I mean, you think about being let down through a window reminds you of, like, Saul in the book of Acts, or Paul in the book of Acts, right? Or Paul's about ready to get beat, like the life beat out of him, and what does he play? What's the card he plays right in that moment strategically? Well, I'm a Roman citizen. Are you sure you should be treating me this way? So it's kind of what this is like. Or it reminds us of Rahab letting the Israelite spies down out through a window so they're not found. In planned escapes, God's kind of using the common sense of others to help save people from a moment that might prove damaging. And in all this, God's somehow working protection. We're going to see that clearly in just a second. God's almost like a genius that's pulling strings and pushing buttons right at the right moment that's for the good of his plan. He's going to get David to the kingdom. David is his anointed. David's going to be king somehow. We're just kind of along for the ride saying, how's God going to pull this off? They're stalking him at his house. How's he going to escape? And God uses this amazing planned escape with Michal and her wit and wisdom. So that's the second progression, the second way that God demonstrates his protection, through planned escapes. Third, chapter 19 ends, as God may work our protection through his powerful spirit. Look at verse 18. Now David fled and escaped, and he came to Samuel at Ramah and told him all that Saul had done to him. And he and Samuel went and lived in Naoth. And it was told Saul, behold, David's at Naoth in Ramah. Then Saul sent messengers to take David. And when they saw the company of the prophets prophesying and Samuel standing his head over them, the Spirit of God came upon the messengers of Saul, and they also prophesied. When it was told Saul, he sent other messengers, and they also prophesied. And Saul sent messengers again the third time, and they also prophesied. Then he himself went to Ramah and came to the great well that is in Sikhu, and he asked, where are Samuel and David? And one said, behold, they're at Naoth and Ramah. And he went there to Naoth and Ramah, and the Spirit of God came upon him also. And as he went, he prophesied until he came to Naoth and Ramah. And he too stripped off his clothes, and he too prophesied before Samuel, and lay naked all that day and all that night. Thus it is said, is Saul also among the prophets? So we kind of have the Spirit just undoing all these plans of Saul. Now you might think, well, what's it mean that they prophesy? Is this proving something? No, it's just showing that the Spirit is just saying, God's saying, I'm in control of this. You want to send your guys to come take my guy? Well, I can foil their plans like this. You know, so that's what's going on. It's amazing. By his powerful Spirit, God himself is actually setting up the protection. David's fled and escapes, and he goes to Samuel at Ramah, telling him all that Saul had done to him. They went down the road to Naoth, and Saul catches wind of it. Some messengers are sent, but they end up being foiled. Prophets are prophesying with Samuel leading them. And as this is happening, the Spirit of God comes upon the messengers, and they prophesy, and it happens three times. So he sends them once, no. Sends them twice, no. Sends them three times, no. It's not going to work. And so finally, Saul decides that if you want something done right, sometimes you just have to do it yourself. And so just like in all the details that led to him being anointed king, if you went back and read, like, 1 Samuel 9, remember, he was told, you're going to go to a town, you're going to ask at a well where Samuel is, and then you're going to find that out. It's being repeated here. Except this time, rather than Saul being made king, Saul's going to come to a well and ask where Samuel is, and we're going to have the undoing of Saul. God's kind of working it backwards. So he enters the town, he inquires at a well where Samuel and David were, and the Spirit of God comes upon him, and he's undone. Now people aren't shocked that he's prophesying like they were in 1 Samuel 9 and 10. Now they're mocking him, saying, is Saul really among the prophets too? This is hilarious. He's like naked. It's crazy. What's he doing? He's lost his mind. That's what they're saying. God has fought for his people. God has protected David. And so, it's in the midst of all this that David wrote Psalm 59. So turn over to Psalm 59. Psalm 59. If you're reading Psalm 59 in Hebrew, you maybe in your Bible have a all capitalized text at the top that kind of gives it a title. So here's what it reads. To the choir master, according to Do Not Destroy, so that's probably the tune, a miktam of David when Saul sent men to watch his house in order to kill him. So that's when this happened, Psalm 59. And listen to David's confidence. I mean, do you have this kind of confidence? If you knew that there were people like from the federal government watching us as we left here today to potentially kill us, would you have this kind of confidence that we read about in Psalm 59? Verse 1. Deliver me from my enemies, O my God. Protect me from those who rise up against me. Deliver me from those who work evil. And save me from bloodthirsty men. I mean, we might walk out praying that, right? Protect me, God. Come to my help. Deliver me. There's bloodthirsty people on my scent. But look at how this all ends. Like look at verses 16 and 17. This is amazing that David would say this. In of chapter 59, as the chapter ends, he says all this. So it's talking about all the way that these enemies are coming after him. But he's got the Lord, who's his shield, surrounding him, protecting him. But listen to verse 16. I will sing of your strength. I will sing aloud of your steadfast love in the morning, for you have been to me a fortress and a refuge in the day of my distress. O my strength, I will sing praises to you, for you, O God, are my fortress, the God who shows me steadfast love. So David doesn't think it was just like a clever escape that got him out of trouble. David knows it was God who did this. It was God who came to his rescue when David was longing for God to deliver him from his enemies, from those who were working evil, from bloodthirsty men. That David was able to sing aloud of the steadfast love of God. And why was he able to do that? Because God was his fortress. God was his refuge. God was his strength. And it's God the fortress who's showing his unending, never giving up love on David by coming to his aid in this moment. So sometimes God works protection for us in that same way. He works his mighty protection in this way. You respond in a situation, you look back, and you don't even realize maybe how dangerous the situation was, but you realize that it was God who was your fortress, that God was the one who made this possible, that it was his covenant-keeping love that was on display in the circumstances of your life, that God was writing a script that you would never have figured out on your own. God may work our protection through his powerful spirit. God can do this. So, back to chapter 20 now, 1 Samuel 20. We've seen three ways that God may work for our protection. He may work through simple appeals, he may work through planned escapes, and he may work through his spirit. Well, there's one final way that God may work our protection, and it's through what I would call the word covenant. That's the fourth and final way that God may work for our protection, through covenant. And this is the whole theme of chapter 20, through covenant. One writer said of this chapter, how do you spell security? C-O-V-E-N-A-N-T. That's how you spell security, covenant. And in chapter 18, you might remember last week, we saw the covenant between Jonathan and David as a demonstration that God was with us. Now in chapter 20, this covenant looms large in protecting David. And so chapter 20 really breaks into four scenes. There's kind of four pieces of action that taken together show how this covenant was protecting David. And it begins with figuring out Saul. So look at chapter 20, verses 1 through 11. Then David fled from Naioth in Ramah and came and said before Jonathan, "What have I done? What's my guilt? And what is my sin before your father that he seeks my life?" And he said to him, "Far from it. You shall not die. Behold, my father does nothing, either great or small, without disclosing it to me. And why should my father hide this from me? It is not so." But David vowed again, saying, "Your father knows well that I have found favor in your eyes. And he thinks, 'Don't let Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved.' But truly, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, there is but a step between me and death." And then Jonathan said to David, "Whatever you say, I will do for you." And David said to Jonathan, "Behold, tomorrow is the new moon, and I should not fail to sit at table with the king. But let me go, that I may hide myself in the field till the third day at evening. If your father misses me at all, then say, 'David earnestly asked leave of me to run to Bethlehem, his city, for there is a yearly sacrifice there for all the clan.' And if he says, 'Good,' it will be well with your servant. But if he's angry, then know that harm is determined by him. Therefore, deal kindly with your servant, for you have brought your servant into a covenant of the Lord with you. But if there is guilt in me, kill me yourself, for why should you bring me to your father?" And Jonathan said, "Far be it from you. If I knew that it was determined by my father that harm should come to you, would I not tell you?" Then David said to Jonathan, "Who will tell me if your father answers you roughly?" And Jonathan said to David, "Come, let's go out into the field." And so they both went out into the field. So this is the first piece of the action. We're getting a sense of how we're going to figure out Saul. So after God's amazing rescue of David in chapter 19, David's on the run again, and he's linking up with Jonathan, trying to figure out what he's done to offend Saul. Where's the sin? Why is he holding a grudge against me? Now, Jonathan thinks he has his old man pegged, but David's a little more cautious. There's but a step between me and death. So he feels like it's looming close. So they arrange for a way to figure out Saul. David will not be there for the new moon celebration, and Saul's reaction will help them understand Saul's intentions. But verse 8 is really what's driving all the action, right? That's where we see this notion of covenant pop up. Look at verse 8. It's a covenant of the Lord that's driving this. This covenant will lead them down a path to protect David. They now need to arrange a plan to get the news communicated. And this is really an expression of Jonathan and David's steadfast love. So let's begin reading in verse 12. Jonathan said to David, "The Lord, the God of Israel, be witness." So again, this is very God-centered right here in the middle of this. "When I have sounded out my father about this time tomorrow or the third day, behold, if he is well disposed toward David, shall I not then send and disclose it to you? But should it please my father to do you harm, the Lord do so to Jonathan and more also, if I do not disclose it to you and send you away, that you may go in safety. May the Lord be with you, as he has been with my father. If I'm still alive, show me the steadfast love of the Lord, that I may not die. And do not cut off your steadfast love from my house forever, when the Lord cuts off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth." And Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, "May the Lord take vengeance on David's enemies." And Jonathan made David swear again by his love for him, for he loved him as he loved his own soul. Then Jonathan said to him, "Tomorrow is the new moon, and you will be missed, because your seat will be empty. On the third day, go down quickly to the place where you hid yourself when the matter was at hand, and remain beside the stone heap. And I will shoot 3 arrows to the side of it, as though I shot at a mark. And behold, I'll send the boy, saying, 'Go find the arrows.' If I say to the boy, 'Look, the arrows are on this side of you, take them,' then you're to come, for as the Lord lives, it's safe for you, and there's no danger. But if I say to the youth, 'Look, the arrows are beyond you,' then go, for the Lord has sent you away. And as for the matter of which you and I have spoken, behold, the Lord is between you and me forever." So they invite the Lord to be a witness to this. Jonathan promises to communicate his father's intentions, and he blesses him. Jonathan blesses David. Remember last week, I think that's so key, because I grew up in church thinking like these were a couple of compañeros. They were just, you know, buddies and pals, and they'd go fight together. And Remember last week we saw that, you know, Jonathan was old enough to be David's father, probably 27 years old, older than him. So this was a significant thing to have this older brother kind of figure confer on him a blessing. The Lord be with you. And on the heels of this, Jonathan appeals to David, recognizing that he's one day going to be king. He says, if I'm still alive, show me the steadfast love of the Lord that I may not die, and don't cut off this steadfast love from my house forever when the Lord cuts off the enemies of David from the face of the earth. Do you hear that? I mean, it's just the confidence. You're going to be king someday. Remember me. We have a covenant arrangement here. We have covenant love that's going to keep this working. So don't forget about me. Don't forget about my house. In fact, David will keep that promise in 2 Samuel. So this love is a covenant-keeping, steadfast love. And so the plan is reached. David will be missed. Jonathan will know the intentions, and he'll shoot these three arrows and have a youth fetch them. There's a signal if the coast is clear and a signal if danger is imminent. And look at verse 22. If I say to the youth, look, the arrows are beyond you, then go, for who has sent you away? What does verse 22 say? That Saul sent him away? No, it's the Lord. It's the Lord who's going to send him away. It's the Lord who's in control of this. That even in the plan of covenant-keeping love, it's the Lord who's working David's protection. The Lord is the one who's going to send you away because the Lord has your back. And as for what they had spoken, the Lord would be a witness between these things forever. So that's the second scene, right? We have figuring out how we're going to figure out Saul, and then we have kind of the plan of here's how we're going to gauge it. Well, let's see what happens in verse 24. So David hid himself in the field. And when the new moon came, the king sat down to eat food. The king sat on his seat, as at other times, on the seat by the wall. Jonathan sat opposite, and Abner sat by Saul's side. But David's place was empty. Yet Saul didn't say anything that day, for he thought, something's happened to him. He's not clean. Surely he's not clean. But on the second day, the day after the new moon, David's place was empty. And Saul said to Jonathan, his son, why has not the son of Jesse come to the meal either yesterday or today? And Jonathan answered Saul, David earnestly asked leave to go to Bethlehem. And he said, let me go, for our clan holds a sacrifice in the city, and my brother has commanded me to be there. So now, if I have found favor in your eyes, let me get away and see my brothers. For this reason, he's not been at the king's table. Then Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan, and he said to him, you son of a perverse, rebellious woman, do I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, neither you nor your kingdom shall be established. Therefore send and bring him to me, for he shall surely die. Then Jonathan answered Saul his father, why should he be put to death? What has he done? But Saul hurled his spear at him to strike him. So Jonathan knew that his father was determined to put David to death. And Jonathan rose from the table in fierce anger and ate no food the second day of the month, for he was grieved for David because his father had disgraced him. So this is the scene of David's absence from the table. Saul's response leaves no doubt where David stands. And the scene was set and David was absent. Saul wondered, maybe David's just unclean. And we begin with a question. So here's how it's going to be. There's a question, there's a revelation, and then there's anger. The question is, why has not the son of Jesse come to the meal either yesterday or today? And then the revelation. Jonathan says, this is why David wasn't there. A family sacrifice drew him away. And we have anger with Saul calling Jonathan the son of a perverse woman. Ironically, you know, Saul doesn't admit any of his guilt in the matter of Jonathan being born, you know, right? Son of a perverse woman and an idiot father, but that's a whole other deal, right? Saul's not owning that, right? Saul knows that Jonathan has chosen the son of Jesse to his own shame. And Saul's motives emerge, right? Why is he so angry? Because as long as David lives, the son of Jesse in this case, Jonathan and his kingdom shall not be established, which means whose kingdom will not be established? Saul's. That's the motive. That's what's driving Saul. His own kingdom. His own ideas. And not God's. It's kind of like my way or the highway. How are you going to stand in the way of this? And in response, we have the same cycle. So Jonathan responds, we have the same cycle, right? So it was question, revelation, anger, and look what happens in response. Jonathan now asks the question, why should he be put to death? What has he done? And the revelation comes by way of a spear meant for Jonathan. And now Jonathan's angry. Jonathan knows his father's intentions. And he's angry. He eats no food, for he's grieved at his father's disgrace. There's a great point of application here, and it's just a simple question. Is maybe part of the reason I'm so angry in this world that I'm seeking to build my kingdom or God's? I mean, it just cuts through so much of this. Might it be that so much of the anger in your life or so much of the frustration you have is because you're trying to build your kingdom and not God's? That's certainly playing out in this broader narrative about God protecting David. Well, all of this leads to the final scene. We've figured out Saul. We've figured out a plan. Now the plans come to fruition. And so the fourth scene is what I'm calling weeping in peace, beginning of verse 35. In the morning, Jonathan went out into the field to the appointment with David, and with him a little boy. And he said to his boy, run and find the arrows that I shoot. And the boy ran. As the boy ran, he shot an arrow beyond him. And when the boy came to the place of the arrow that Jonathan had shot, Jonathan called after the boy and said, is not the arrow beyond you? And Jonathan called after the boy, hurry, be quick, don't stay. So Jonathan's boy gathered up the arrows and came to his master. But the boy knew nothing. Only Jonathan and David knew the matter. And Jonathan gave his weapons to the boy and said to him, go and carry them to the city. And as soon as the boy had gone, David rose from beside the stone heap and fell on his face to the ground and bowed three times. And they kissed one another and wept with one another, David weeping the most. Then Jonathan said to David, go in peace, because we have sworn both of us in the name of the Lord, saying, the Lord shall be between me and you, and between my offspring and your offspring forever. And he rose and departed, and Jonathan went into the city. So the arrows are shot, the sign is given that David's in danger. Jonathan sends the boy to the city with his weapons, and the boy was gone. David rises, meets up with Jonathan, bows to the ground. He's very grateful that Jonathan has done this. There's a weird thing, you know, like when Jesus says that unless you hate father and mother, you can't be my disciple. I mean, this is just kind of playing out right here, right? Jonathan is choosing to put the interests of the Lord's anointed above his own interests and the interests of his father and serve. And David gets that, right? He bows three times to the ground. They both express just the deep emotion and grief. We're told here that David was weeping the most. We haven't seen much of any kind of emotion from David. He hasn't really talked a lot. You know, he's talked about being in danger, but we have this emotion that he's weeping. And Jonathan assures him with these words, go, in verse 42, go in peace. Go in peace. He wants David's soul to be at rest. Right? So there's like an individual peace, you know, blessing, go in peace. You know, there's nothing between us, go in peace. But I think his offer of peace is also spiritual because it's the Lord who will be between them forever, right? He wants the Lord to bring this peace to him. From here on in the book, David's going to be on the run. Like, there's no more returning to the palace for nice spear time with Saul. That's not going to happen anymore. From here, if you read the next chapter, David's going to be hiding in a cave. He's going to be intercepted. Saul's going to be chasing him around the desert. Next week's passage, really bizarre. David's going to actually go to Philistine land and act like he's crazy trying to escape Saul. So David's going to be on the run. So he departs from the city and Jonathan returns to the city. So God provides David the answer he needs for protection. And God does all this through this covenant that he has with Jonathan. This covenant between David and Jonathan is the vehicle that's driving all this protection of David. It's an amazing thing. In the upper room, Jesus and his disciples had an emotional farewell as well. And listen to how that love reached culmination. So right before the high priestly prayer in John 16:33, Jesus says, "I've said these things to you that in me you may have peace. In this world you will have tribulation, but take heart, I have overcome the world." We sometimes are very bewildered with how God may work. But the peace that we long for is found in God. This is what Jonathan was driving at for David. I want you to be at peace in God. So the next chapter, two psalms are going to be birthed out of the experience of 1 Samuel 22. Be at peace. And it's the same for us. God is with us. God, our fortress, is working for our protection. And he's working for this in our lives out of his covenant-keeping love. He's never giving up on us. Even though it may feel like everything in our world is crashing down, he is there with his relentless love coming after us time and again. So in conclusion today, we've seen four ways that God, our fortress, works for our protection. In chapter 19, it was through simple appeals, through a planned escape, and through his powerful spirit. And then in chapter 20, God worked protection for David through the covenant between Jonathan and David. So as we wrap up these two chapters, one application is just to trust God for protection, to trust him. So do you have a relationship with him? Are you able to lean into him when times are tough? It might be that you don't have confidence for his protection because you treat him like a genie in a bottle. So trouble comes into your life. Times are tough, you rub the bottle. Oh, God, please help me. I need you. So that he can pop out whenever you need him on your timetable. But God's not like that. God's operating out of steadfast love even as you're rebuffing him. Even as you're ignoring him and just have no need of him in your relative prosperity. He's showing you steadfast love there. He's operating out of mercy. As one song from a friend of mine says, in the good times and bad, he's on the throne and he's God alone. That's who he is. So relate to him then by turning from yourself at all times. Don't think that in the good times you got this. You need him then. And certainly run to him in the bad times. I'm not saying you shouldn't run him, but trust that no matter what times, whether it's good or bad, that he's with you. He's on his throne. He's protecting you. He's your fortress. And cling to him in the midst of that. And if you're a believer, this is your confidence. God's working for your protection in countless ways. I mean, there's all kinds of applications in these two chapters. Applications related to whose kingdom you're living for. Applications to loving God over family. Applications to being committed to others. I mean, are you committed to anyone in the same kind of covenant way that David was committed to, or Jonathan was committed to David? But it's really that big theme of protection, I think, that is kind of directing us through this narrative. God is not deserting you in the middle of trials. When trials come your way, please don't think, God, where are you in the midst of this? He's there. He's with you. So one writer put it this way. You want evidence that God hasn't deserted you? It comes not as you're out of the trial, but as you are on your feet in the midst of them. And so today, if all you could manage to do was get here, it's a sign of God's protection. It's a sign that he's with you. It's just a sign that you are on your feet, that you are still alive. He is with you. That's evidence that God's with you. Not that you're out of the trial, but that you're on your feet in the midst of the trial. And we're going to see this with David, that God's protecting and working his plan each step of the way. He's with you. He's your helper. Therefore, you don't need to fear. You don't need to fear. So use this narrative today to feed your faith, to rest in God, your fortress, that you may glorify and enjoy him forever.